China is taking more drastic steps to contain the spread of the coronavirus.
The Chinese have done a public health experiment on a scale unprecedented in human history.
I'm Marco Werman. The global outbreak has now spread to more than 24 different countries. Meantime, in Australia, rainstorms put out those massive wildfires, but the recovery is just beginning.
A lot of people are still living in tents and caravans where their houses once stood.
Also today, a powerful trade union in France is planning another transit strike, and the late Mexican-American icon Selena, her legacy still helps define what it means to be Latino.
It really helped me identify with a Latino person that I had never been able to kind of comprehend.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, you're with The World. In just the last 4 months, more than 250,000 Americans have been hospitalized, and 14,000 people have died in this country from an infectious respiratory disease. If you are getting alarmed by those numbers, know that I'm talking here about the flu. These are actually pretty typical numbers, according to the Centers for Disease Control. By contrast, the total number of cases for the new coronavirus in the U.S. stands today at 15, with no deaths. Globally, the number of cases of COVID-19, that's a disease caused by the virus, is at 64,000. I just wanted to put things in perspective before rolling out today's coverage. New figures from China today highlight the plight of health workers. More than 1,700 have now been infected, and six of them have died. But the World Health Organization says most of those cases among doctors and nurses occurred earlier in the outbreak. The WHO's emergencies chief, Dr. Michael Ryan, spoke to reporters at the organization's headquarters in Geneva today.
We've always known that health workers are in the front line. We've said in many, many occasions here that the real front line and the real point of entry for a virus into a country is a busy emergency room, an unsuspecting general practice clinic. So we have called again and again for the training and equipment of workers because we understand those risks. And we do believe that it is possible to manage patients with the coronaviruses very safely with the proper training and the proper protective equipment. And we need to send a reassuring message out there.
There have been reports, though, of shortages of protective equipment in China, and there has been a spike in the numbers of new cases. Authorities in the central province of Hubei are tightening controls on the population. More cities are sealing off residential areas to prevent people leaving and allowing only emergency vehicles on the streets. Michael Adeni is a PhD student from Ghana in West Africa who's been stuck in his dorm in Wuhan for 3 weeks now.
We are not allowed to step out of the house or out of the dormitory or hostel. You are only allowed to go out when you have a medical emergency. And if you want to go out, you need to seek permission from the student counselor. It's like a solitary confinement. The major problem is because we are basically restricted to our rooms, some of the students are experiencing panic attacks, emotional and mental breakdowns. People, they cry. They are in their room, they are crying. Or they will call you and they are crying at night. They can't sleep, they can't eat.
Dr. William Schaffner is an infectious disease specialist at the Vanderbilt University School of Medicine in Nashville, Tennessee. Things have been moving very quickly with this story. So today, Friday, what is the most noteworthy news about COVID-19?
Well, what's happening, Marco, is apparently China is diagnosing more and more infections within Wuhan. That's interesting because we had been hoping that the number of infections would be receding as a consequence of this extraordinary quarantine that they have put in place. So I'm watching that very carefully.
There is a continuing criticism of the lack of transparency in China. I mean, are you getting the information that you need from China?
Well, we would hope that the contingent of folks who are going there on behalf of the World Health Organization, and I would say I wish the Chinese had accepted the offer from the CDC, but I hope those folks will help regularize communication so the rest of the world can get a better idea of how this outbreak and its control measures are progressing.
I'm curious, Dr. Schaffner, when it comes to quarantines, as well as travel restrictions, how effective are they?
Well, they're not thought to be terribly effective except in isolated individual cases. You can isolate one person here, another person there, quarantine another there. That would work. But in the past, quarantines of larger communities, unless they were very isolated rural communities, really didn't work very well. So the Chinese have done a public health experiment on a scale unprecedented in human history. And so we're all eager to find out exactly how well this did work. But we haven't gotten the information yet to allow us to draw any conclusions.
What about who's at risk for COVID-19? Because it's my understanding with the 1918 flu pandemic, it was young, healthy adults who were at risk. So for COVID-19, who's the most vulnerable to catching the virus and dying?
Well, we're getting information out of China such that the pattern appears to be similar to other respiratory infections such as influenza, namely older persons who are frail, and then younger persons who have underlying illnesses, heart disease, lung disease, diabetes, and the like. And then in addition, on occasion, just a normal, young, healthy person can get a viral infection and be severely ill. Now, in the United States, the difference between our threat from influenza at present and coronavirus is really rather stark. It's very modest for coronavirus at present. We clinicians have that very much top of the mind. We're making these diagnoses very promptly. Patients are being well taken care of. And then our public health partners are right on the job, finding all the contacts of those people and putting them under surveillance. So in the U.S., unless you've just returned from China or you've had recent close contact with someone who's returned from China, your risk of coronavirus infection is very tiny, thankfully.
How likely is a wider outbreak in the United States?
Well, we can have best and worst case scenarios, but my particular take on this is that at the moment, we're diagnosing and confining our patients, following the contacts very well. So I think we'll obviously see more cases, and there may be small bursts of transmission here or there, but public health will jump on those. I do not think we are going to have widespread epidemics in the United States in the near term.
Finally, Dr. Schaffner, how far away are scientists from a vaccine or something similar? What are you hearing?
Everybody's working overtime on both vaccines and new therapies for this coronavirus. But that will take, both of those will take months. So they'll help us on the back end of this problem, but not in the immediate future.
Dr. William Schaffner, an infectious disease specialist at the Vanderbilt University School of Medicine, thank you very much for the latest.
My pleasure, Marco.
Great news from Australia. The New South Wales Rural Firefighting Service has confirmed that all the bushfires it had been fighting are now contained. The devastation they caused, though, is hard to fathom. More than 11,000 separate wildfires, more than 13 million acres of land burned, 2,500 homes destroyed. Petra Campbell lives in the Nambucca Valley on the north coast of New South Wales.
A lot of people are still living in tents and caravans where their houses once stood, or actually right next to the debris of their former houses.
Many of the fires were extinguished thanks to the rainstorm we told you about a week ago, but now the problem is that rain has not let up. Record-breaking fires have been followed by record-breaking rainfall. Flood warnings have been issued for New South Wales and Queensland. Margaret Tedros lives in a part of Australia known for its fruit farms.
So we've gone from fire to flood. Our dams were empty after the fires. We've been going through severe drought. And right after the fires, a lot of our water had been used through the fires, so we had no water left. And normally it would take our dam 3 weeks of consistent rain to fill up. And within 24 hours of torrential rain that we had, our dam is completely full. So we've now got enough water to last us 3 years if we don't get any rain.
For Australians like Margaret and Petra, the whole ordeal has been overwhelming at times.
It's been 2 weeks and we still can't go home. It's just incredible to be living this extreme of natural crisis. 1 minute, these horrendous bushfires that so many people lost their lives in, and then the next minute, we're up to our necks in water. Unreal.
Australians are still assessing how much they lost in those wildfires, and that includes countless animals, wild and domesticated. We're going to bring you the story now of one animal and his human. It's told by Danielle Selemeyer. She and her partner were sheltering two pigs, Jimmy and Kate, who had been rescued by activists from a slaughterhouse. I'll let Danielle take it from here.
Jimmy was quite a happy-go-lucky pig. He would love to spend hours in his bath, covering himself with mud or in the nests that he'd built himself. So one of the things that I used to do was to take a book and I would go into what I call their world, where they live, and I would lay out a blanket. And Katie used to come and sit right next to me. And sometimes I would put my head on her side. And Jimmy would walk around and then he would lie a little bit away from us. It was peaceful and joyous. On the 26th of December of 2019, the fires started to come close to where we live. So I called the woman who had been Jimmy and Kate's original person, the first person who had rescued them. And when she picked up the phone, she said that she had been half expecting my call and she would be there the next day to come and get them and take them to her place and give them sanctuary until it was safe to bring them back here again. A couple of days later, there was a missed call on my phone from my friend. I called her back and she just said, "It's all gone. It's all gone. There's all black around me." She and her partner had been outside when the fire had approached on three sides. They had gone into the house, lain flat and had their mouths against the ground to try and have the little bit of oxygen that's still left. The windows blew in, the fire came inside. Her partner threw her onto his back and escaped miraculously. About an hour and a half after I got the phone call, I got a text saying that they had found Katie's body. We assumed that Jimmy was also dead until I received a video of Jimmy running out of this completely blackened landscape, making his beautiful baritone sounds, coming back home, and he was alive. He'd survived this inferno. When we drove down to collect Jimmy, he was frenetic. He was hypervigilant. And my sense was that he had been so assaulted on every sense. The heat must have been beyond anything that he would have experienced in his life. The noise is like being underneath a train. And the smell of the ash, all of that happening at the same time, out of nowhere. His whole body was so overcome by the trauma that he seemed to constantly be looking, listening, smelling around him for some type of repeat of the fire, of the horror that he'd experienced. When we got home, Jimmy started to look around, and I'm assuming that he was looking for Katie. He would go down into the woods, he would go up under the trees, he would go around his house. And then a few hours later, he went down in the cool wooded area and he didn't really get up again for about 2.5 days. And my sense was that now that he was home, he could let go of that hypervigilance that had been keeping him in movement before. And with the relaxation came the realization that Katie was dead. Now he's better. It feels like he's returning to life. And at the same time, there is also the missing there. There's no overcoming the loss that he's been through. There's no replacing his sister, who he spent every single day and night of his life until that ferocious fire, and now she's gone from his life and she's not coming back.
What a story. Danielle Selemeyer in southeastern Australia. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. You're with the world. The César Awards, think of them as the French Oscars, are just 2 weeks away. That made yesterday's announcement all the more shocking. The entire board that runs the awards process resigned. That's because they had come under fire for embracing Roman Polanski. He's the director who fled from the U.S. to France after pleading guilty to statutory rape in the 1970s. The World's Sarah Birnbaum reports.
At the Oscars last weekend, Natalie Portman showed up on the red carpet wearing a Dior cape embroidered with the names of female directors who were snubbed by the Academy.
How did you decide to do that?
She's saying, I wanted to recognize the women who were not recognized for their incredible work this year in my subtle way. And that's about as controversial as the awards got stateside, which doesn't hold a candle to what's been going on in France. France has been much more forgiving of directors like Woody Allen and Roman Polanski, who have faced renewed criticism in the age of Me Too. Polanski's latest film, An Officer and a Spy, couldn't find a U.S. distributor. He's persona non grata here. But in France, it did find a distributor, and the César board recognized the movie with 12 award nominations.
Au nom du peuple français! Le premier conseil de guerre du gouvernement militaire de Paris.
The film is about Alfred Dreyfus, the Jewish officer who was wrongfully convicted of treason in the 1890s. Wait, a film about false accusations? No, that's not a coincidence. Polanski, a convicted sex offender, has been pretty heavy-handed about comparing his own plight to the Dreyfus affair, the most well-known example of miscarriage of justice in French history. Feminist groups have boycotted the film screenings, and this week they wrote a blistering open letter in the French newspaper Le Parisien. One line says, if rape is an art, give Polanski all of the Césars. Céline Peake, whose organization signed the letter, argues there's something specifically French about all of this. She's saying that in France, male artists get a free pass to do what they want to women and girls. She also notes that around the time the film was released this fall, another woman came forward accusing Polanski of rape, which Polanski denies. The César board initially dismissed the complaints from feminist groups. Alain Terzian, the president of the Academy, said it could not be expected to take moral positions when evaluating films.
This isn't a forum for debate. We've given the results from the first round, and I must respect equal treatment for everyone and not comment on anyone.
The Academy seems to have abruptly changed its tune with the mass resignation of its board. A new board will be elected after the award ceremony in 2 weeks, but Roman Polanski's film is still eligible to take home a dozen statuettes. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
We're getting news that the U.S. and the Taliban are closing in on an agreement of some kind. The World's Shirin Jafari joins me in the studio. Shirin, what do we know about the details so far?
Well, Marco, Secretary of Defense Mark Esper told reporters today that the U.S. and the Taliban have reached an initial deal. We know very little about the content of this deal because the negotiations are still ongoing. But American officials have signaled that there is going to be something called a reduction in violence from all sides that are involved in these negotiations. And that reduction of violence is going to continue for 7 days. The deal is between the U.S. and the Taliban only. The Taliban so far has refused to sit down with the Afghan government, but the news today seems to be like a step forward in the negotiations that have been going on for months now.
And that phrase, reduction in violence, it sounds like official protocol. What does that mean?
That's a really interesting way that they've worded this, Marco. What it means is that there's not going to be a complete ceasefire because the Taliban would not agree to a full-on ceasefire. So the negotiators came up with this terminology of reducing violence. And the Taliban will agree to significantly minimize its attacks across Afghanistan for 7 days, and the American and Afghan government forces will do the same. The idea here is that this will be a confidence-building measure, presumably towards something bigger, which is, you know, a negotiated peace deal. And the next step for the U.S. will likely be to reduce the number of troops in Afghanistan. There are currently about 13,000 American troops in Afghanistan, and that will go down to about 9,000.
Shirin, what should we be looking for next with this story?
While the U.S. is withdrawing its troops, the Taliban and the Afghan government will sit down to negotiate their own agreement. I think this is going to be where things are going to get tricky because, as we know, the Taliban has been fighting Afghan forces for about 2 decades now. And it's going to be really interesting to see what comes out of these negotiations and whether the Taliban will agree to reduce its violence.
The World's Shirin Jafari, thank you very much for the update.
You're welcome, Marco.
Okay, what is the most romantic city in the world? That, of course, depends on whom you're asking. But a village in the UK thinks it should be in the running. Just start with the name. Lover. Okay, it's actually spelled L-O-V-E-R, but pronounced Lover. Today, though, on Valentine's Day, people call the place Lover. It's a picturesque little village in Wiltshire in the southeast of England. And for years, people would send their Valentine cards to the local post office there to be stamped with the words, sent from Lover, Lover. Then the post office closed in 2008. 4 years ago, residents in the village decided to set up their own pop-up post office just for Valentine's Day. And now, once again, people from all over the world are sending their cards to Lover to get the special Lover stamp. Nick Gibbs is one of the volunteers who runs the pop-up post office.
We sent cards to every continent in the world. This year, I remember posting cards out to US and Canada. We posted one out to Taiwan. We actually had to send one to China, the address of which was written in Chinese characters. So that gave us a bit of a challenge, I can tell you. And do you know what? This year, we've even got a presence on the Falkland Islands. And I have just received notice that we have got a card going to Antarctica to a scientist on the cap.
Half of the village is taking part in the effort. So did Nick himself receive any cards?
Yes, I received one and I sent one. Neither of us knew that we were going to do it. But yeah, of course, you know, when you're involved with this, and my wife is involved with this as well, you've got to do it, haven't you? I mean, it's a wonderful thing to do. And I've been married almost 50 years to my childhood sweetheart, and I am a romantic.
Wow, that is sweet. And if you happen to be traveling through Southeast England on Valentine's Day, you'll know when you've come to the village of Lover, because the entire place is decorated with hearts, if that is your sort of thing. I do love you. A lyric that says, I love you, check. A crooner in falsetto, check. A rhythm that makes you want to grab your partner and dance real slow. It is the perfect song for Valentine's Day. It's even got a Jamaican rock steady groove. I do love you. Ooh, ooh, yes, I do now. Jackie Edwards, the Jamaican hitmaker from the 60s and 70s. Back in the day, Jamaican artists were as tuned into R&B stations on the U.S. East Coast as they were their own roots music. And American soul singers like Billy Stewart, who sang the original version of this tune, were big influences on the Jamaican songbook. Here's more of Jackie Edwards' cover of I Do Love You for this February 14th.
Mm,
That helps. Jackie Edwards' cover of I Do Love You came out in Jamaica in 1977. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. A new natural gas pipeline in Canada would cut right through indigenous land, but protesters showed up and could put a stop to the project.
A few days ago, I'd probably say, oh, no way, this is going on full force. But with all these protests, there's no end in sight.
That story's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH Boston, and PRX. The deadly coronavirus outbreak that started in China has now spread to more than 24 different countries. Today, the first confirmed case was reported in Africa. Health officials in Egypt said the affected person is a foreigner and was placed in isolation. Global health experts say it was only a matter of time the virus reached Africa, and that's because of the growing relationship between China and many African nations. The world's Halima Gikandi has more.
Africa and China are more connected than ever. There are Chinese restaurants in Nairobi and African designers in Guangzhou. Lina Benabdallah studies China-Africa relations at Wake Forest University.
Diplomatic relations between China and African partners have seen booming relations with many exchanges, including economic exchanges, cultural exchanges, diplomatic relations, and more recently also security and military relations.
China has become Africa's top trading partner over the last decade. There are Chinese businessmen and construction workers working all across Africa, and African students and entrepreneurs based in China. They rely on new direct flights that go back and forth between African and Chinese cities. But that also means that when the coronavirus appeared in Wuhan, one thing was clear. Those same connections also created a possible pathway for this deadly virus to come to Africa.
The National Institute of Communicable Diseases has assured South Africans that the country is prepared for any eventuality of a coronavirus outbreak.
Health officials are on high alert across the continent. Michelle Yao heads emergency operations for the World Health Organization office in Africa. He's based in Brazzaville, Congo.
The big concern is to be able to detect and manage a case that could be introduced in the African countries.
Yao says countries that dealt with the Ebola outbreak are better prepared. Many of them already have detection mechanisms in place. And in recent weeks, the number of laboratories in Africa that can test for coronavirus has increased from 2 to at least 15. But many African countries are still vulnerable. They might be able to handle small numbers of confirmed cases, but those can quickly become an outbreak. Yao says, unlike China, most African countries are not prepared to quarantine or keep tabs on large populations.
Imagine in an African country having hundreds of cases and thousands of people to be followed up daily, to be monitored the temperature and to be referred to a treatment center when they get sick.
That would be a worst case scenario. So for many African leaders, the priority is stopping coronavirus from entering the continent in the first place. Kenya's president, Uhuru Kenyatta, expressed his concerns during a conference in Washington, D.C. last week.
We don't have the capacity to build hospitals in 7 days. So we must do everything that we can within the limited resources to ensure that we keep this virus completely away.
Keeping the virus away can seem like a race against time, especially considering the volume of travel between African countries and China. Last month, Kenya's national airline, Kenya Airways, canceled its direct flights to Guangzhou, and other airlines are under pressure to do the same. But Africa's biggest carrier, Ethiopian Airlines, is still flying. Some see this as a political calculation. I spoke with one Kenyan student who is studying political science in Wuhan. She's frustrated that the Kenyan government won't evacuate its students. She didn't want to give her name because she fears losing her government scholarship, but she says African governments don't want to jeopardize their relationship with China, which is one of the top investors on the continent.
They're thinking about how are we supposed to get our citizens out when we owe China this debt. So they feel that we become like sacrificial lambs.
sacrificial lambs caught in the complex relationship between China and African countries. U.S. officials have criticized how Chinese investment has put African countries in deep debt, but the relationship goes both ways. African leaders released statements of support for China in this difficult time, and the small country of Equatorial Guinea in Western Africa said it would donate $2 million towards the coronavirus relief efforts in China, and a company in South Africa pledged to donate surgical masks. These small gestures seem to be part of a bigger message that African countries consider China to be a friend in good times and bad. For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi.
We've seen versions of this story before, and it's happening again. Protesters in Canada trying to stop a proposed natural gas pipeline. The pipeline is supposed to cut right through Indigenous land. Now, Canada's National Rail Company has announced it will be shutting down some services because of blockades by protesters. CBC reporter Angela Sterrett has been following the story.
This is a pipeline that cuts through several First Nations communities in the northwest of British Columbia. It has been the center of this dispute that's been going on for more than a year now in Wet'suwet'en territory. The hereditary leaders in this area are against the pipeline, but the elected leaders, many of them have signed on and signed agreements with Coastal GasLink. What we're seeing unfolding right now across the country is a number of people who are in support of the hereditary chiefs, and these protests are going on right across Canada.
So what is the difference between hereditary leaders, like if we're talking the Wet'suwet'en First Nation, and the Band Council? Who has more power?
Hereditary chiefs follow a traditional form of leadership that follows the matrilineal line, so through their mother. Mm. A hereditary chief can be groomed. For example, my grandfather was groomed by the time he was 11 to become a hereditary chief. However, it's a huge responsibility. You have to pay a lot of money. Back in the day, it would be goods, hunting, gathering, things that you produce. Today, it's money. It's a huge responsibility, and it takes a lot of work. So my grandfather said, no, I don't want to do this. And my uncle Neil Sterrett took over the role and became the hereditary chief of Wigaq. Mm. So in Wet'suwet'en territory, there are 13 house chiefs who have decided among themselves and through the community, through a vote actually, that they didn't want this pipeline to go through. That is at odds with the elected system. The elected system is a byproduct of the federal government that came in to Indigenous territories in 1867 and allotted people reserve lands, so putting them on tiny pieces of land, not their traditional territories, and appointed men, so not the women, the matriarchs in the community that these communities were used to following, that would decide upon things like healthcare and education. But all of that power flows and still flows through the federal government. So they're very different in terms of who they're responsible to. One is responsible to the community. The other is responsible to the federal government. One more thing to make it even more complicated is at the time of colonization, the traditional forms of government, so the hereditary chiefs, were suppressed because the European colonizers that were coming over said, your forms of government are inferior to ours. And that's why we're seeing such a confusion right now, because there was an assault on the hereditary systems. They've weakened because of colonization. So it's complex.
Has this kind of split happened before with the Wet'suwet'en, with a dispute that is so consequential?
We have seen divides always in terms of hereditary leadership and elected leadership. However, that doesn't mean that there's this black and white situation that's in communities. You do see hereditary leaders who are on band councils because some of the hereditary leaders want to influence the band councils to become more traditional. You know, you also see people who want to make the hereditary systems more democratic. So you see this crossover, and that's not uncommon. What is very unique about what we're seeing right now in Canada is that you see these protests popping up, you know, via rail, canceling trains nationwide.
Right. On the eastern side of Canada, the Mohawk Nation in Ontario is protesting in solidarity with the Wet'suwet'en in BC.
That's right. And via rail, temporarily ending most passenger services nationwide. Huge. You also saw on the West Coast protesters forcing and canceling the West Coast Express this morning, closing down like this huge section of the population who are trying to get to work in the morning. Every morning that I get up, it's like, okay, which route should I go? Because there's going to be protesters here, protesters there, or I need an extra 70 minutes to get home. So what you're seeing now is people saying, why is this going on? I've got to look this up. Oh, this is about hereditary chiefs. Mm. What the heck is that? People having this intricate idea and knowledge of what a hereditary chief is, it's giving power to those forms of government that were suppressed. So we're hearing things even that don't have to do with the land, even in child welfare, where people are considering going to the Supreme Court of Canada saying, look, you didn't consult with our hereditary leadership. So there's a lot at play right now, and there's a lot of change happening right beneath our feet.
Yeah, I mean, a dispute over the pipeline leading to discussions of all sorts of other things. How much pressure are the protests and the train blockade putting on the government of Justin Trudeau right now? Could it stop actually the construction of this pipeline project?
It's interesting kind of how slow the leadership here has been to act. And we don't know what's going on behind closed doors besides them having conversations on the phone with each other. The federal government does have jurisdictional authority over our railways and so far has refused to intervene. We know that Indigenous Services Minister Mark Miller has agreed to meet with the Mohawks. Those are the nation that is blocking or disrupting rail service in the east. And we know that John Horgan, the Premier of BC, has said that he's going to meet with Gixxan chiefs and Wet'suwet'en hereditary chiefs in the north, but we don't know when that will be. So from a journalist perspective, it seems like they're dragging their feet a lot. And if this will shut down that Coastal GasLink pipeline, a few days ago, I'd probably say, oh, no way, this is going on full force. But with all these protests, there's no end in sight. Maybe they're going to have to take a second look and do proper consultations with the entire community to get a better idea of how they can do better.
Angela Sterrett, a reporter with the CBC, speaking with us from Vancouver. Angela, thanks for getting us up to speed on the story.
You're welcome.
Strikes in France. Some joke. It's a national tradition there. And don't you know, next week, trade union leaders say they will shut down public transportation again. They're protesting the French government's plan to reform the national pension system. At the center of this pressure campaign is one of the most militant trade unions in the country. Anita Elash reports from Paris.
Garbage trucks are slowly working their way down a narrow road in the center of Paris. It's their first trip in 4 days, and there's a lot of garbage. The streets are blocked with bins. The bins are overflowing with cardboard boxes, food scraps, and wine bottles from restaurants. Technically speaking, garbage workers in Paris are not on strike. They left the garbage lying around because other workers shut down incinerating stations outside the city. So the garbage has piled up in neighborhoods like this. People who live here tell me they're annoyed. Bruno Dupont is a local shopkeeper. He says the strikers are ruining the image of Paris and the entire country.
Mauvais pouvoir. Chantage.
Philippe Guinard is a retired businessman. He tells me the unions have too much power. They represent a minority but control the majority. They're interfering with people's lives. The union behind the garbage strike is the militant CGT. In English, that's the General Workers' Confederation. It's the second biggest union in France and the only one that says it won't back down until the government gives up its plan to modernize the pension system. The CGT's leader is Philippe Martinez. He's a former member of the Communist Party, but these days he and the union have a different rallying cry.
C'est une lutte pour la justice sociale. C'est une lutte pour l'égalité.
Martinez says he and the CGT are now focused on social justice and equality. He promises to keep up the pressure with what he calls innovative actions. Those militant tactics have included the garbage strike, shutting down ports, and cutting electricity to thousands of homes, an international airport, and the world's largest wholesale food market. Not surprisingly, perhaps, those actions have been widely criticized.
Alors, où est l'intérêt
de détruire l'économie. Et je
Some of the more conservative news media in France and this popular television talk show host accuse Martinez and the CGT of harming the French economy.
Mais c'est pas détruire l'économie,
Martinez defended his union's tactics on the talk show. He said the strikes hurt the economy, but said that was not the point.
Quand il y a des grèves, il y a des inconvénients.
Martinez said the strikes are inconvenient, but he said everything the union has done is legitimate.
Ces manifestations, ces coupures d'électricité, les grèves.
Camille Dupuis is an industrial relations expert at the University of Normandy. She says the CGT has become more militant as unions in France struggle to prove they're still relevant.
One of the things is in play in this social movement is what is going to be the power of trade unions.
Most workers still support trade unions. More than 60% vote to choose their union leaders. But President Emmanuel Macron has refused to give in to union demands on any major labor reform.
If trade unions are defeated again, I don't know what will be trade unions after that. Maybe the government will assume that they are killing trade unions if they don't hear trade unions at all in this reform.
Monday will be a key moment in all of this. That's when the French Parliament starts to debate its new pension law. The CGT and other unions promised to show their strength. They've called for another nationwide transit strike. For The World, Anita Elash, Paris.
These are trying times for Washington. Just last week, the European Union's top diplomat described the United States as, quote, not very friendly. We are not foes, he went on to say. We share common values. Talk about setting the bar low. That's the atmosphere, though, as heads of state, diplomats, and national security officials from around the world gathered in Munich today. It's day one of the annual Global Security Conference there. German President Frank-Walter Steinmeier opened the conference with a warning. He criticized the world powers for pursuing self-interested policies.
Aber ich befürchte, wir werden gerade Zeugen.
I fear that we're witnessing an increasingly destructive dynamic in world politics, the German president said. Steinmeier accused China, Russia, and the U.S. of making the world less safe, and he singled out President Trump's motto, Make America Great Again, though he did not mention Trump by name.
Und unser engster Verbündeter, die Vereinigten Staaten von Amerika.
Steinmeier said the U.S. is Germany's closest ally, but the current administration rejects the very idea of an international community, he said. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau was also in Munich. He warned against populism and said that nationalism is on the rise.
De plus en plus, les citoyens doutent des bienfaits de notre monde.
More and more citizens are doubting the benefits of an integrated world, Trudeau said. Their impression is that globalization is only benefiting the rich. People are attracted to populist movements, which exploit their anxieties, Trudeau continued. The result is that countries are withdrawing into their own borders. We'll continue to follow the conference through the weekend. Selena Quintanilla Perez, or simply Selena, she was a Grammy Award-winning Mexican-American singer. Selena was known as the Queen of Tejano music, Tejano being that mix of cultures that emerged along the border area between Mexico and Texas. Here's Selena at the Tejano Music Awards in 1995.
Woo! San Antonio! Quiero dar gracias a todos ustedes. Para el grupo Selena y los niños, es un gusto para nosotros recibir este premio. I would like to say thank you.
Just months after that, Selena was killed by the manager of her clothing boutique. Her fans were inconsolable. Today, though, Selena's legacy is as strong as ever. Nathan Rodriguez teaches at San Diego State University. He actually teaches an entire course on Selena as a way to explore Latinx media representation. He's also just a big fan.
I spent a lot of my early childhood in San Antonio, Texas. And I grew up listening to Tejano radio stations. I was always listening to the radio, trying to win stuff. But I grew up in a very patriarchal Mexican household. And I consider myself a son of an immigrant. My grandfather was like my father to me. He was from Mexico. And he spoke Spanish. My grandmother spoke Spanish. My mother and her brother spoke Spanish. And growing up, they really wanted me to speak English first so that I would be successful in school. And so because of that, I grew up in a household hearing Spanish all around me, but I spoke English. And so I didn't speak Spanish correctly. I was kind of pocho. So I never really felt like I belonged. I was always in the middle. I wasn't Mexican enough, American enough. So when Selena came along and I was able to hear her.
Selena, bienvenidos a Tejano USA.
Thank you, Waldo. It's good to be here.
To sing in Spanish, but speak in English and talk about her own identity and mispronounce words and fumble on some of the Spanish that she had. It really helped me identify with a Latino person that I had never been able to kind of comprehend. This person that was in the middle, that was, you know, living a bicultural life. So I saw a lot of myself in Selena. She helped me, myself, negotiate my, you know, Tejano identity, knowing that there wasn't one correct way to be a Latinx individual. And that's really how she resonated with me. And growing up, I just kind of always, you know, looked at Selena as a person that was just authentic.
When they first told us that we were nominated, we all freaked out. We couldn't believe it. And the person,
she was herself, and she never apologized for it.
Like, I have to take a camera so I can take a picture with all these stars.
Right. Yeah.
It didn't hit me later until I was like, oh my God, what if we win, or, you know? Yeah.
Grammy award-winning music star Selena has been shot and killed in Texas. The 23-year-old Mexican-American...
Selena died in 1995. That was 25 years ago. In the years since, how have you seen Latinx media representation change?
I think that we're going into a more positive direction. We're also going into a direction where Latinx identities are not monolithic, right? A lot of times everybody automatically thinks Mexico, but Latinx is so much more than just a country or a nation or a geographic space. So I see the direction in the current landscape since Selena's passing really starting to encompass this kind of blending of sorts of different types of sound and people to make what the Latinx individual is or representation a lot more intersectional. Now, that doesn't mean that it's portrayed more often. I think it's just the few portrayals that we do have are more intersectional, and we still have a far way to go.
Nathan, I'm imagining that on day one of your course, you've got to be playing some music. Is there a tune by Selena that you feel captures not just who she was, but also what she represented then and now for Latinx culture?
I think that there's many songs that Selena has. You know, when I asked my students, you know, what songs they remember and what songs speak out to them, the first one was Como La Flor, which was her first number one hit in Mexico, but also in the United States. And I think that really speaks to her ability to cross borders, to cross genres, and also to cross generations, that students now who weren't alive when Selena was alive are able to remember that song and it means something to them. The song lyrics also talking about being given something and then it withers away and you're sad about it now. And I think that also speaks to kind of this Latin mourning of all the different things that are happening in terms of the militarization of the border, in terms of DACA students, you know, being scared, in terms of children being put into cages. It really speaks to this whole Latinx culture of, you know, wanting and belonging and not being able to have it. And then, of course, you know, and I think in a more kind of literal way, it also speaks to the fact that we're still mourning Selena and we're still looking for, you know, those positive Latinx role models that transcend barriers and genres and generations, and we're still searching for that. So I think of all the songs that, you know, students bring up, Como La Flor is really that one that speaks to it.
Which one are you most likely to sing along to?
I sing along to all of them. I know every single song. I have every single Selena cassette and CD. And of course, I have all of the playlists on my soundtrack. On my iTunes. And so I'm always listening to all Tejano songs. I mean, any Selena song that comes on, I'm automatically singing it. There's not one that I don't sing along to.
Wow, super fan. You still have the cassettes.
I do. You know, my mom was a very Tejano fan, and so she collected cassettes. She actually had friends of hers who worked in nightclubs make her mixtapes. And so I grew up just listening to cassettes and just kind of keeping them.
Nathan Rodriguez, an assistant professor at San Diego State University. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much, sir.
This is Selena's English hit, Dreaming of You, a track that came out after her death. The music lives on. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here Monday.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.